previously on Nighthawk's podcast.
Also, just since we haven't spoken about streaming for a while, what have you been watching lately, Matt? Anything worth mentioning?
I'm only 20 minutes into it, but I'm quite taken with it.
This is how you do nostalgia without slavishly pandering.
Oh, this is so welcome. This is the old fun horror made with modern tools.
We're pretty excited for Stranger Things. This has that look and that feel and that tone of some of the darker children's adventure films from the 1980s.
That sort of, yeah, you know, like you said, the Monster Squad, Spielbergian horror.
And there's tons of references to 80s horror and to genre and stuff in there that I think the Gen Xers are definitely going to get a huge kick out of it. Probably some of the older Gen Y.
But that moment early on when the kid looks out into his yard, I was like, wow, that can still work. Like, it's a very simple scene, but it worked.
If the first two episodes are any indication, folks, this is the next great Netflix series. This is what people will be talking about around the water cooler. And if they're not, come find somebody who watched it and talk about it, because this is worthy fan fodder.
Should I stay or should I go now? Should I stay or should I go now? If I go, there will be trouble. And if I stay, it will be double. So come on and let me know.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is the Nighthawks Podcast. I'm Trevor T. Trujillo. With me, as always, is my co-host, my partner in crime, the right arm to my left arm. Is that a thing?
Just don't call me the Harley to your Joker.
Yeah.
It is I, Matt Foster.
We are film critics over at fanboytv.com, as well as hosts of this fine show, a podcast for people who like to stay up after midnight. Thank you for joining us wherever you are, whatever time of day it is for you. That's the beauty of podcast, is that appointment radio isn't a thing anymore. You can listen to this whenever the hell you please. And as a matter of fact, I don't think we mentioned this in the last episode. We're on Stitcher now.
Yes, we're rapidly taking over the world of non-airwaves.
But yeah, we are on Stitcher. So if that is a service that you have been using or that you use that you haven't been able to get Nighthawks through previously, now you can. And it would be a big help to us if you listened to us there and maybe gave us a rating, subscribed. We're also on iTunes if you prefer to go that route. Subscribe and leave us a review over there. We're on Facebook. We're the Nighthawks Podcast. We're on Twitter at Nighthawks Pod. I think that's about it for our little corner of internet real estate, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, it's a small media empire. The Vatican City of media empires. Small, but importune. Festive and joyous.
So speaking of festive and joyous, we're going a little off the beaten path here today, folks. This is a movie podcast, but you know what? It's our movie podcast, and we can do whatever the hell we want with it.
Breaking the law. Breaking the law.
We're not talking about a movie this week, folks. Sorry to disappoint. Sorry to drop that bomb on you. What we are talking about, I think, is among the better media I've seen this year. Since it is a audiovisual medium, we figured we could probably bend the rules a little bit and talk about it today. But we are talking about a TV series that first season is available on Netflix as a Netflix exclusive. It was a Netflix-produced show. They have just been greenlit for a second season, so we have that to look forward to as well. But we're going to be talking about the out-of-nowhere phenomenal Stranger Things.
Yeah, it's a real shot across the bow, just not something anybody was expecting to just appear out of nowhere like that.
Yeah, we had about maybe 2 months warning on this. I can't remember when they released that first teaser trailer and people were like, what the hell is this? fast forward to now, the night of this record, it's starting to catch fire. And I think by the time this episode drops, people will be fairly well familiar with it. I'm going to tell you right now, we highly recommend this. It is great horror. It is great science fiction. It's got a lot of nostalgia to it. And so what we're going to do is, in case you haven't seen it yet, we're going to do a tiered spoiler system. So right here at the top of the show, if you haven't seen the show yet, we're not going to ruin anything for you. We're going to be talking very broad strokes, so that way everybody can get a little something out of this. And hopefully we pique your interest into checking this out. As we proceed further, we're going to go into the second tier, which is going to be plot points, things that unfold early in the series that may not necessarily be talking about any kind of resolution, but they're elements that are best discovered over the course of the series at its own pace. So we do have that kind of buffer tier, and then the third tier is going to be gloves off, no holds barred. That's going to be deep into spoiler territory there.
I don't even know how far past the spoiler curtain we need to go. I almost want to just leave the suspense for them.
You want to do that instead?
Do you feel the need to parse the plot in intricate detail? I mean, we're asking for an 8-hour commitment for out of people. That's sort of an all-in push. Like, come on, people, just watch it. Watch it. Watch the show.
I'll tell you what.
Watch the show.
You have compelled me. Folks, it's up to you. Go out there and discover the unknown. So, but right now, I think we can speak very generally on this. I was a big fan of this. Matt, you were too.
Yeah, this caught me kind of flat-footed and ended up digested in two prolonged sessions. It's 8 episodes of roughly an hour. They're individually, they vary a little bit.
Right off the top, this is an old story that goes back to 2007. It was my first year attending South by Southwest, and there was a lot of discussion going on right then is what was going to be the future of home media distribution. This is the first time I ever heard about a streaming website, a website that streams films. It was such a mind-blowing concept, and I wasn't real keen on it at the time.
Trevor, get off my lawn.
What can I say? I'm a Luddite. But one of the things that I actually ended up taking away from that, and I actually kind of pitched it to a few people, was what if we skip the actual broadcast medium altogether and we just start producing shows and releasing them direct to DVD? Because direct to DVD isn't the prison for cinema that it used to be. It used to be if something was released direct to video, it wasn't particularly high quality. And so that was seen as kind of a death sentence. Well, in the last few years of home media, in the last few years of DVD, and then the kind of in-between years of Blu-ray, there was a lot of stuff that was, you weren't going to see it in your theater. Whether it had a national release or not, you could still find some gems kind of out among the direct DVD crowd. So I had kind of pitched that idea. What if we start doing TV? And then we don't have to worry about standards and practices. We don't have to worry about censorship. We don't have to worry about this episode has to be exactly 37 minutes long. Netflix has kind of taken that ball and run with it and turned it into its own thing. Not that, you know, not that I'm the one who told Netflix they need to start producing shows. It was a similar genesis of thought. Stranger Things is able to play within those loose rules of a direct-to-video format for a television series. Some of the episodes are a little longer. Some of them are a little shorter. They just take the time they need to tell the story. They have, they have in mind, it's like, well, we don't want it to run much longer than an hour. But if they don't hit that mark hard, it's okay. They can still take their time to do what they want to do, whereas you would not have that luxury in network television or cable.
I don't know. One of my guilty pleasures is the creepypasta sort of basement of the internet, the no sleep Reddit, welcome to Night Vale, that kind of thing. And Stranger Things feels kind of ripped from those pages. What I said in my notebook was that Stranger Things is a kind of dark techno-Cthulhu fable of government psionic research gone wrong. It's set in the early 80s, and it just sort of expertly invokes the right amount of nostalgia as it tells us sort of what follows when there's kind of an intersection between worlds and what comes out of them. What follows is a kind of blend of little horror, little coming of age, little buddy comedy, and a lot of solid science fiction, which for me, That was a thing I really liked. I've been getting really weary of by-the-numbers horror things where the message is ghosts are real, and the nerd that tells you, there's no such thing. This EVP is just static, and you're hearing what you want to hear. That guy always ends up dead, and that drives me nuts. And I like to see a horror movie James Randi could watch without an aneurysm. And Stranger Things gave me a little hit of that sweet, sweet skepticism.
In this first tier, I think it's safe to say that this is kind of, it's a children's adventure film. Well, it's not a film, it's a series. I think I made that mistake last episode when we recommended this to people. If you want to check out the tail end of our Ali episode, it's a children's adventure, but it's not targeted to children as a demographic. Children can watch this, and I'm sure they'll get a little bit out of it. You may not want the super little tykes into this. There's some teenage drinking and some John Hughes sexual escapades. It does focus on the kids as the central protagonists. We have some adult protagonists, too, for those of us who are now grown to kind of be able to use as proxy. But, yeah, it's this curious happening in this town, as told from the point of view of these three kids. And it's really, you look this up, you can't turn around on Facebook and not hear this, about how well it evokes the 1980s and how much it feels like a Steven Spielberg Amblin Entertainment film. Something in the vein of, like, Goonies or E.T. or, any of a myriad of others. But it also has just this generous heaping gravy of Stephen King horror influence kind of drizzled over the top of it.
Well, and the trick with the nostalgia here is they lean into it exactly enough. They don't make a big lampshading deal. It doesn't have the, like, Gorbachev and Reagan on the television. It doesn't have the sort of heavy-handed materialism or nuclear jitters kind of themes. It just is the 80s. And it's kind of brought off with a perfect amount of it that keeps you from ever being snapped all the way out of it. It actually kind of reminded me of It Follows, where we had this tale that was really suspended in time. There's even, I kind of want to make a point of mentioning, even on the kind of scenes that are supposed to be the present of the narrative and the quote-unquote real world, there is a certain treatment of color. Like, there's a kind of almost shadowy patina over everything that gives it an unreal kind of forgetting quality that I thought was really intriguing, because the visual design of Stranger Things resembles memory. Like the corners of the rooms aren't quite there. The ceiling seems sort of more oppressive. The environment seems a little smaller, and it really doesn't just invoke the time. It invokes being the age of the protagonist at the time, which is, like, crazy difficult to pull off. Like, it's a really good trick. You know what else I thought was cool, kind of speaking of the industry difference? I think it's really interesting that, and of course, it's still formatted for Netflix, so it still has episodes in the menu, but it doesn't have an episode 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 that are all 47 minutes long. It has chapters, and the chapters go from plot point to plot point. They're slightly different in length, as though they just said, oh, this is how much of it we're going to put before we put a bathroom break in it. It's a sign that the season structure itself may be becoming a bit of an appendix.
And I'm okay with that, because honestly, part of the imagery, and it's all done intentionally, they're evoking this nostalgia intentionally. They mean to do this. But, like, you even take a look at the font of the title card on this show, and it looks like that old Stephen King font. It looks like the font of the cover of a Stephen King book. They don't use that font anymore, so right there, automatically, if you grew up in that era, it takes you back. And then you've also got this really cool synth theme and score, which is actually done by a couple of local Austin composers, but it's kind of in the line with John Carpenter. And so while it's kind of facetious, and this is getting thrown around a lot too, but there is a lot to be said about this feels like a TV series written by Stephen King, directed by Steven Spielberg and scored by John Carpenter. That's kind of an oversimplified way of putting it, but it's not inaccurate. It does feel like that.
I'd say scored and with creature effects by the John Carpenter team.
Yeah.
But that's not as snappy of a soundbite. And in fact, there are a couple direct winking nods to John Carpenter in this. The Thing is mentioned on purpose several times.
Yeah, you noticed the Thing poster hanging up in the background of one of the scenes. I don't know that we're going to get too much into first-tier spoiler territory here when I say this is also really helped by the fact that our introduction to some of these young protagonists is four kids sitting around a table in a basement surrounded by all this 80s memorabilia that all of us owned at one point in our life, and in one form or we knew somebody who owned it. And they're all playing Dungeons and Dragons, and they're taking it super seriously, and they kind of let slip that they've been playing for 10 hours, which is another something that I think a lot of the nerds that are kind of in that weird Gen X, Gen Y cusp are going to be really able to relate to as well. So what this whole feeling evokes is an instant kinship, an instant bond, not only with the TV series itself, but with the protagonists that are in there. We see them as audience proxy. And I'm curious to know, and I haven't asked anybody, but I kind of want to know if this is hitting the millennials on quite such a visceral level. I don't think it would, but I think the series is good enough on its own that it's not going to matter. The millennials are going to dig it as much as we do, just for different reasons.
But the fact is, for all intents and purposes, we are millennials for the purpose of this movie. I don't know, you were born in 81, weren't you?
Yeah.
I was born in 79. I'm old. And so we would have been pre-kindergarten when this is set. So it's not really, should not be nostalgic for us either. And that's the point I was making, that it's, they managed to build the look and feel of this thing in such a way that you actually feel you're in the time and you're the age of the characters. Like it, well, not literally, but it's good. Their point of view is there, the sort of looming adults and the size and scope of the architecture and the way they sort of drop off the map when they go from place to place and the adults are not around. I got to mention It Follows and Brick are two other favorites of ours where the sort of grown-up world just disappears. What's great about Stranger Things is they do that when they want to, and then you also have compelling, complete arcs with the adults who ultimately don't fail the younger half of the cast the way they often do in horror movies. And that's probably a gift of the format. We aren't restricted to one set of characters. We have the luxury of following everybody because we have a little more, we have more pages of script here. We have a little more airtime. The length of the storytelling here, and you mentioned earlier, it feels a lot like a Stephen King story, and it's very characteristic of Stephen King's writing that almost everyone is fleshed out deeper than most authors invest in extras and throwaways and victims. And we see that here, so I almost wonder if that King-like quality... I was about to ask if it was a coincidence, but it's not. I mean, it's a deliberate invocation, but it's definitely enabled by the format. I have high hopes this format might lead to some better King adaptions.
I also believe, while they are definitely playing in the 1980s sandbox, and they know the 1980s rules, they're not bound by them. We get these fully realized stories with some of the adults in this community, which is something that we didn't necessarily see in these 80s children's adventure films. You know, we didn't see that in Explorers. We got a little bit of Dee Wallace being a single mother. We got some glimpses of her in E.T., but she didn't have a complete arc. While they're approaching this like it's a story told about, set in, and involving the 80s, they also know that, well, now that it's not the 80s anymore, we're gonna build a little bit more on what we've learned now as well. There are some direct references not only to E.T. and The Thing and Explorers and Goonies. There's also a visual homage to Under the Skin, which is a science fiction alien movie that came out, 2 years ago, 3 years ago? It really is playing with its full basket. It's like, you know, when the 80s isn't going to work, we're not afraid to bend the rules a little bit. This is a show made in 2016 we're going to be able to use some of the modern tools as well.
The technique here is very modern. Like, it's not bound technically by the... It's not... You said not slavish, but I would say it's not orthodox. Like, it's not a retro production. They used every modern tool they had to give them the comprehensive look and feel they wanted. So it's not as though they're busting out vintage technology to do the series. You know, one thing worth mentioning here, and again, they... At one point, some people are actually watching the thing, and they discuss the effects in the thing. there is quite a bit of seamlessly overlaid digital and practical horror effect here. It is that artful use of CGI that doesn't make you wince or cringe.
Kind of jumping off of that, one of the little actresses in here who will go on to be probably, if there is the protagonist of the series, you could probably say it's this little girl. The actress's name is Millie Bobby Brown, and she is fantastic. I mean, seriously, line up an Emmy for this little girl immediately. She does more just in subtlety with, like, a tick of a facial expression or a look. She does more and can convey more subtext and more emotion just by doing that than a lot of adult actors that we see working right now can do with full body and voice. What's weird is we're kind of coming into a weird era, because this low-key, subdued style of acting is very new, relatively speaking. You take acting back to where it came from and into a theater, you have to make your performance and your emotions known very broadly, because you have to convey that emotion not only to the person sitting in the front row who can count your nose hairs, you also have to convey it to the guy in the back row who can barely make out your face. That's where we see this kind of de-evolution, the kind of de-broadening of acting as a style, and now we've been spurred even further. I mean, movies kind of brought it, because movies, you always have a front row seat. So we were able to bring it down a few notches. And now that we're entering into the realm of high definition, I mean, her performance would be lost if you were to transfer this series onto VHS and let it age 10 years. Her performance would be lost. I mean, the subtlety would be lost without the high-definition technology available. And I think it's an interesting thing to see this generation of young actors coming up now that are understanding this, and they're growing in this world of micro-acting. And it's really, really fascinating.
As much as we zip around in time, we definitely see the level of melodrama has shifted in movies, and the sort of... Because every piece of movie dialogue, and like, this is like the grand criticism of Kevin Smith, is that people, they think his dialogue is better than it is because he writes how people think instead of how they talk.
Yeah.
That's true to a degree. And then you go back and you watch, like, especially like a lot of the 70s action movies, there's a slight difference in the phrasing and the meter. Some of that is actual linguistic drift, and some of it is that the writing itself was a bit more formalized and a bit more melodramatic, and I think it was an audience contempt, like a remnant of elitism in the theater. Like, they thought that a movie plot had to be very clear, that they wanted it even to be kind of linguistically dumbed down. And now we're to the point where, and Netflix is infamous for this. Right now, they're the hot ticket. They're the people you want to develop with if you're an independent filmmaker, or if you're a, like, comedians in particular are coming out of meetings with Netflix, and then they're getting on their blog or getting on their Twitter or getting on their podcast and saying, wow, man, Netflix gets it. I sat down with them and they said, do what you want. We trust you. We hired you. We're going to let you do your thing. And so they're notorious for being the guys where they don't give you any meddling executive notes. They get on there and they go, can you make it darker? Do you need to swear more? Yeah. And I think also, I don't know if it's because of a lack of those constraints, or if it's a lack of that meddling, or if it's a deliberately plotted course, but there's also a lot of representation in Netflix originals. Sense8 was almost had to be super deliberate, and they were highlighting a theme of difference and commonality as kind of a yin yang thing. But then here in Stranger Things, we see the one thing that's missing from a lot of the actual 80s movies is the non-nuclear family is usually portrayed fairly negatively, and there's a certain vanilla quality to these suburban neighborhoods these things are always set in. And here we see there's some diversity. There's two kinds of representation. I was just thinking about this, something that'll come up later when we talk about the thing we're going to talk about at the end. But there's incidental representation where the people on the screen reflect reality. There's no whitewashing where it's cited as, well, we just couldn't get the actors. You know, Broad City is something I champion for that because the street casting there is realistic. Like, it seems like you're really walking down a diverse New York when they take to the streets of New York in Broad City. Then there's sort of deliberate, we're going to invert the traditional casting of a role, or we're going to make a point out of telling a story from an alternate point of view. And I think the incidental, casual representation ends up making the deliberate representation, it lets it happen in a way that is less forced. And I think it's a bullpen thing. I think the fact that we're seeing sort of a deliberate attempt to reflect reality, if not reality plus, is deepening the pool of talent that's not craggy, white, cisgendered males. And we'll talk a little further about this. Neil Gaiman has been quietly writing both of those types of representation for a long time now.
Uh-huh.
Like, if you read an Aussie Boys, you get partway through it before you realize it is a story about Britons of African descent, and nothing really is made of it until it just kind of clicks about a third of the way through the book. And it's funny to me because, you know, there's that talk of how everybody's a little bit racist and what, you know, what color is Hermione Granger to you when you read Harry Potter?
Yeah.
And I understand the family that's key to that story is Caribbean. But I always forget that a bunch of the supporting cast is too. And you're like, oh, yeah, of course. Yeah, well, why not? You know? And it's tragic enough if the white reader pictures everybody in the book as white for no particular reason. And it's doubly tragic if the non-white reader does.
Well, no, the casting here is fantastic. I mean, they look like real people. They look like people from the 80s. There's a teenage character in here. She's like the best friend of one of our protagonists. She has like the 80s octagonal glasses and the mom haircut with like the big billowy pants and the bad sweater. There's characters in here all shapes and sizes. It looks like a real town occupied by real people. The main little kid, Mike is his name, is kind of this waifish little scrawny little guy. And then we have the troubled loner teen, and he's not particularly handsome, but he's not unattractive. And then you've got the hunky good-looking dude who actually isn't that hunky or good-looking. And they're real. It's not Hollywood. And I think that helps us key into this as well. On top of the fact that we now have, even in 1980, a world where we have characters of multi-ethnic origin. And so, yeah, it is really refreshing to be able to see a movie like this, set in this place and time, evoking the memories of those movies that I watched way back when, but we're doing it with a modern sensibility.
The net effect is something that looks more like reality probably looked. Like, it's an increase in veracity, and you have to be careful doing that, because you can... That canard of special effects that if you make a dead body look too real, people think it's fake.
Basically, folks, we really want you to discover this series on its own. I think I was really lucky because I just happened to be awake. I think we had just wrapped up a podcast record the night that it dropped, and I just haphazardly hopped onto Netflix and said, oh, this is that series. I'll give an episode a go. You know, 3 hours later, I'm texting you. Are you awake yet? Can you get on this? And it really is a fantastic series and is worth the mention and a watch. And give it your time and love and attention. Talk about it around the water cooler. Get other people involved. It's great storytelling. It's great cinema. It's television. And we are really entering a fantastic era for television. There is some things to get granular about with Stranger Things, and I think we're going to do that now. So I don't know, Matt, do you have anything on this side of the spoiler curtain before we throw up that warning?
I think the performances turned in by the adults here are good too. Like this series clearly belongs to the younger generation in it, but there's a couple adults here like David Arbor, who is a guy that
oh God, he blew me away in this.
He always plays kind of a like he always plays the stepdad or the jerk neighbor or the corrupt cop. My comment to you partway through this, when he kind of finally clicks into action mode in this, I was kind of like, I think I'm going to go on Twitter and start tweeting hashtag David Arbor for Mike Hammer. Because he finally got a little bit of a star turn in something and pulled it off perfectly. The modern action hero is kind of a different critter from the historical action hero. And I like the performance he turned in. Winona Ryder is the mother and the kind of beleaguered, scrappy mother of the missing boy. Also, the older sister.
She has her own little story arc going, and that's another thing that this invokes. She almost has this weird side story that will eventually, I mean, everything comes together in the end, and this is a smart, well-crafted script. I do want to put that out there. But her story arc is almost John Hughes, and so we get a little of the Pretty in Pink, a little bit of the Breakfast Club kind of angle in the older sister story arc.
I was pitching it to someone else. I called it the It's Going to Eat You for Breakfast Club. But I think it's time for you to hit that that big red button. Whoop, whoop, whoop.
Repeat, confidence is high.
Covert data, this is an exercise.
Negative, this is not an exercise.
All right. Flush the bombers, get the subs in launch mode. We are at DEFCON 1.
DEFCON 1.
So here we are. We're going to be talking about some introductory elements of the story. Basically, we start the kids leaving the Dungeons & Dragons game. There's a bicycle race involved. One of the kids ends up getting separated and is pursued into the darkness by something we don't know what. The next morning, everybody wakes up. This kid isn't at school. His friends start to worry. Missing posters start going up. His mother is, of course, beside herself. The ex-husband is getting involved. The older brother is getting involved. His best friend feels especially guilty.
Will is missing. I don't know where he is.
99 out of 100 times, kid goes missing. The kid is with a parent or a relative.
What about the other time?
What?
You said 99 out of 100. What about the other time? The one. The one.
Guys, I really think we should turn back.
Did you guys hear that?
That's not Will. You're in trouble, aren't you?
We've sealed off this area.
This is where it came from?
Yes.
And the girl?
She can't have gone far.
Find three.
You really think it was a coincidence that we found her the same place where Will disappeared? Something is going on here!
What the hell?
She knows about Will!
Is there any way that you could reach him?
Yes.
And so the kids kind of conspire that they're going to go out and look for their friend. They're not supposed to leave the house. They're not supposed to go out on their own. Nobody knows what's going on. Everybody's worried about their kids. But the kids kind of plan a jailbreak. Get out of the house. They go searching for the friend. Well, what they find instead is a mysterious semi-mute young girl who is interesting and is being pursued by a kind of shadowy government force. Not knowing what to do, they pick her up, but as it turns out, the disappearance of the young boy and the appearance of the young girl have something to do with each other. When we were talking about Millie Bobby Brown, she plays 11. This is this mysterious girl. I said she's semi-mute, and that's not fair. She is able to vocalize, but she has this naivete to the world. It seems like somebody who was raised fairly or in a very sheltered atmosphere where they don't necessarily click. They understand English, they can communicate, but they understand nothing of the world around them. And so most of her performance is silent, and my God, is it a just fantastic performance.
Yeah, she's really quite nuanced. Where they found her or how they coaxed it out of her, but she certainly defies the stereotype that you don't necessarily get a top-tier performance out of kids. And the other kids here also give very, very high-quality performances. I hate to keep beating the drum, but I think it has to do with the format.
Yeah, I think the directors, the Duffer brothers, directed most of the episodes and are the series creators who kind of, they themselves came out of nowhere. I think they had one feature film that they had directed, and they had executive produced on a TV series, Wayward Pines, which is kind of a similar things of the unknown happening in an idyllic suburbia. They kind of came out of nowhere, but there's some selective use of takes I've noticed in this that allow the kids to kind of be more naturalistic. Like, there's a scene where, I think it's in episode 2, I think his name is Dustin, the poor little kid with no front teeth, is they're arguing about what's to be done with this girl that they've found. And this girl had kind of demonstrated her naivete for things like privacy when they give her some dry clothes and then she goes to change right in front of them. And they're like, whoa, no, here's the bathroom. But Dustin is making a big to-do about this. And he's like, she just lifted her shirt above her head. And as he does this, his arms kind of catch the bill of his cap and the cap falls off. And then he kind of looks down and it's this shockingly natural moment that you wouldn't see in another movie because they would say, oh, the hat fell off, back to one, let's shoot the scene again. No, the Duffers just kind of let it happen. And so it adds this weird degree of realism to it. And I think there may be even a little improvised dialogue among the kids because they talk like little kids. I remember having those conversations with my friends. And so, I mean, they're either improvised by the children themselves or expertly written. I'm very taken with this TV show. Can you tell?
I can tell a little bit. What made this really make our heads itch and make us want to talk about it on mic is this is a kind of almost a clinic on how to arc everybody in here. Starts as a stereotypical kind of 80s horror sci-fi character, and then something slightly different happens to their story. And so we get David Harbour, the troubled cop, who we're introduced to, hungover and late for work. And then we find out by the end of the series, he has quite a bit of steel and some backstory of his own and makes some interesting choices to extricate himself from the situation he's in and hints at a little bit of past baggage of his own. And that depth and that closure elevates this beyond the pitch. The elevator pitch here is that a creature is stalking the residents of a suburban town and a mysterious young escapee from a mental ward might hold the key. You know, that's the log line for Stranger Things.
Yeah.
But the writing here of every significant character is quite a bit more exceptional. Like the nebbishy brother of the missing kid, Will, who is distinct from Mike, and they both have siblings. So excuse us if we mix when we say the brother and the sister. The brother and the sister are romantically conflicted, but one of them is Will's brother and the other one is Mike's sister.
Yeah.
I believe. Did I get it right?
Yeah, you got it. You got it.
So they are the brother and the sister, but not of the same youngster. Like, he is sort of presented as the typical kind of ducky 16 candles nerd, but they're not afraid to let him be a little creepier. And then Steve, the kind of high school bully and instigator, he turns out to actually be you know, he breaks ranks with his classmates a little bit and shows unexpected character. And there's a lot of subtle subversion here that is very kind of, I don't want to keep saying refreshing. It's not refreshing, but it's iterative. It breaks it out of genre. It makes it a complete drama that has action and sci-fi themes instead of a sci-fi thing with a nod to character development.
No, that's a good way of putting it. Yeah. Well, you know, there was a lot of talk when The Dark Knight came out, for example, where it's like, oh, this isn't a superhero movie. This is a crime film where the people involved just happen to wear funny clothing. And I think that's kind of what you're talking about. Yes, this is a sci-fi horror series, but really it's a well-thought-out drama that has those elements. Yeah, you're absolutely right.
I don't know what to say when someone says I'm absolutely right. That never happens to me.
What we spur off here is we've got basically, I don't know, three or four intertwining narratives, which, again, is allowable because of the format. The story of Mike and his friends doing what they can to find their other friend, Will. Then you've also got the story of Eleven, who is this mysterious girl they found in the woods, and kind of where she's at and what she knows in her story arc. Then you've also got Mike's older sister, who is on this kind of love triangle that also happens to involve monsters. Kind of the last rung on the ladder, you've got the adults in the community. You've got Mike and his parents, who are a little more B characters. Taking center stage, though, is Hopper, who is the cop. He's actually the chief of police, and then Winona Ryder's character as the mother of Will. They have their own kind of separate story arc going, and the way they kind of interplay and combine is interesting to watch. It does a lot for displaying character motivation. We know why all of these characters are doing what they're doing. And it's something that you didn't see. It's the other side of the coin. What else was happening in the neighborhood when E.T. was hanging out with Elliot? Was there some other stuff going on? Well, this gives it the chance to kind of explore that element. And so we've got this little girl who may or may not have some kind of strange abilities. And then we've got this creature who is stalking these townspeople. And then on top of that all, you've got the townspeople who are trying to digest all of that. And the cool dichotomy we get is you've got the young kids who are kind of like, oh, this girl may have powers, and our friend maybe have been kidnapped by a giant monster from beyond. And they're able to process that, get over it, and then do something about it. Because they come from this world where they still believe in imagination. They still play Dungeons and Dragons. They still go outside to play cops and robbers. They read fantasy, and J.R.R. Tolkien is mentioned a couple of times. Their minds are still in this young, innocent, ready to embrace magic and monsters as real. Then on the other side, you've got the adults who don't handle it quite as well, that they may not understand the true nature of the world. And so it's a really cool dichotomy that we get all these different perspectives. And then you've got the older sister who's kind of at a place in between, and kind of her coming of age story and becoming an adult. The dichotomy of the ages, and it just shows a natural progression. It's just constructed so very, very well.
This is Jiro Dreams of Sushi level precision in craft.
Yeah.
Like everything here is super deliberate and super correct. There's really not much of a misstep here. I was kind of hard pressed to think of some criticisms. Like, and the only thing I can come out with is, do you think maybe they beat the nostalgia drum too hard? Do you think there's too much E.T. in here? Do you think there's too much The Thing in here?
I don't know that there's necessarily too much of any one given property. And I don't even want to say that there's too much nostalgia, because I think they do it well. I think they utilize nostalgia in this better than, say, Super 8 did. The Ghostbusters remake that just came out had a lot of throwback to the original films. I think this is handled at an expert level in Stranger Things. But yeah, you know, I didn't need as much of it as they gave me. But I know people really, really do love that. I was that weird guy that was kind of peshy on Ready Player One because it was a little too much nostalgia, pop culture reference, and not enough, you know, nightmare dystopia outside. But I'm definitely in the minority on that. So even with me saying, they could have taken it easier, I still don't think it's a problem. It's not a criticism. And I don't think anybody else is going to have a problem with it. I don't know. Do you? Am I wrong?
I kind of decided, no, you're not wrong. Like, I think they hit the right lane. I was left with really few complaints. I'm not bothered by this at all. You know? How often does that happen in this modern era of giving things 1 to 5 stars?
Well, one of the interesting... I mean, this series grabs you, I mean, instantly. You're either on board or you're not in the first 10 minutes. And so we're seeing that kind of interesting release model now where services like Netflix or like Amazon Prime will release just for free on YouTube or on Facebook the first 10 minutes of their project. So, I mean, there are places where you can watch the first 10 minutes of Stranger Things gratis. Real quick, I want to talk about stakes here. Like I said, it's not a series that is targeted at children, and the stakes here are real. There are some folks who are in real jeopardy here. There are some folks that we're going to meet at the beginning of the series and are going to be there by the end of the series. And I think the Duffer Brothers, I read in an interview they did with, it was either Variety or Entertainment Weekly or something, where they were talking about how that is intentionally crafted. They killed off certain characters to let you know that nobody is safe. And so that's a very real component of this that I think is expertly done. Honestly, just, I love this series. I'll tell you what this is, Matt. Last year, I said this, and this is not hyperbole. I said this and I meant it. I was chemically in love with Mad Max Fury Road. It gave me...
That's true, you were.
...a weird charge. It was just a weird emotional charge watching that movie. Matt, I am chemically in love with Stranger Things. This is...
It was pretty good.
I am just over the moon with this series.
Hey, should we move to the if-then sort of section of the product here?
Sure, what'd you have in mind?
If you like Stranger Things, then you'll also like... We have Stand By Me, which is a Stephen King short story adaptation that happens to be something with no supernatural content. It's the rare, pure coming-of-age story from Stephen King. And then another Stephen King adaption, Firestarter, the very early Drew Barrymore vehicle. And then I'm going to say one that I don't believe you've seen, which is the Midnight Special.
Oh, yeah.
Which is a recent release that is, again, very, very much in this lane. So those are sort of cinematic wine pairings here.
You know, for me, it's what do you do? Do you just... You just start cherry picking out of the bucket of, I mean, basically what we're looking at is media produced by fans of the media that you and I both grew up on. And so they're forming themselves in the style of Spielberg and Stephen King and these artists that made an impact on our generation. So, I mean, you can go right to the source material. You can go to Poltergeist. You can go to E.T. You can go to It. You can go to The Goonies. You can go to The Monster Squad. If you want some more grown-up fare, you can go to Twin Peaks. You can go to Under the Skin. Any of the Christine or John Carpenter, just the list goes on and on and on. I don't know that I can even pick one specific thing to pair with this, although... you know, start sniffing around. Start looking at some of those Netflix original series and see if you key off on any of them. I really do think this is the future of television. And honestly, we haven't talked trailers in a while. And we're going to wrap up the episode by doing that. But there is going to be a little bridge here on kind of the release model that we've seen for this and other Netflix series, as well as kind of what's happening in Hollywood now with theatrical releases that I think is going to be interesting. But, Matt, do you have any closing thoughts before we move out to the Nighthawks food trailer?
No, I don't. I eagerly await the tasty delights of the food trailer. I think I'll order the pushed metaphor or the fatigue theme.
Nothing. will keep us together. We could still die just for one day. We can be heroes forever and ever. What you say?
So here we are. We are we have trotted outside onto the street corner, and we're getting some delicious trailer fare from our Nighthawks food trailer. The metaphor doesn't get any better. You keep stressing it; it just gets worse. But anyways, we haven't talked trailers in a while, and San Diego Comic Con is the haps. It's what's going on, and that's prime territory for a lot of trailer activity. And there's a couple that, one of them has me quite excited. The other one I'm throwing in here because it fits into this kind of release model discussion I want to have. But it's also the sequel to a movie we've discussed on the podcast before. So the first one we're going to queue up is another series that I'm excited for. And if it ends up shaping up pretty well, maybe we'll do a special television episode for it as well. But we mentioned Neil Gaiman earlier in the episode. We're going to bring it back full circle. The adaptation of his novel, American Gods, is getting the series treatment from Starz. And they've dropped a roughly 2-minute first look trailer. And so we're going to watch that right now.
So what would I call you if I was so inclined? Shadow Moon, what might I call you?
What's today?
Wednesday.
Today's my day.
I could use a fellow like you. You're my man now.
You know who he is? Who he really is?
He does not know our world.
I'm easing him in.
I think I'm losing my mind.
They told me you died.
Who said I died, puppy?
Seems you have a choice. Either the world is crazy, or you are. Come with me.
So, yeah, that's American Gods trailer. That's that just looks terrible, and I want nothing to do with it.
A liar! That looks incredible, does it not?
Pretty into it. It looks like the thing in my head from when I read the book.
So yeah, let's dust off our old metrics and talk about whether or not this is. Obviously, we're both excited for the series, but let's talk about if this is good trailer. What say you?
I think this is a good trailer. It's a little light content wise, but it has enough hints. It focuses, without spoiling, on the relationship between Wednesday and Shadow, which is kind of the most central thing, but it doesn't get out and spoil a lot of the sights. So I think it's a good hook setting trailer.
Yeah, I think somebody who isn't familiar with the source material, obviously we've both read the book by Neil Gaiman, which, if you haven't, is fantastic. I would encourage you to go out and read it before you see the series. Just because, I mean, it's one of my favorite books of all time. It's definitely on the Desert Island list. I think if you're not familiar with that, it's a compelling trailer. I think if you are familiar with it, though, it's a damn exciting trailer. And so maybe I think this is kind of trading on people who are familiar with the source material a little bit more, that San Diego Comic-Con crowd, the guys that are kind of plugged into the weird kooky stuff. And so I think that's who is for. We'll get a better, more general audience trailer, I think, a little later on down the road. But I'm super excited. I don't think anything is particularly spoiled in here if they're sticking with the story in the book.
The guy that's obviously playing Chernabog, That was exactly my stunt cast for it.
Oh, yeah?
That's exactly who I always pictured him as. Yeah, Peter Stormare. Why couldn't I remember that?
Yeah, Peter Stormare. And then Cloris Leachman is Zoria.
That's also good. Orlando Jones is Nancy.
Yeah, I saw that yesterday, too. I'm actually kind of okay with that. You know, I'm super excited for Ian McShane. You know, I've loved that guy since Deadwood. You know, I think I had read American Gods before I was introduced to Deadwood. And so I never really pictured Ian McShane in that role, but my God, how perfect. I'm super excited. So what do you think? Do you think this is, I mean, if this ends up panning out okay, do you think this is indicative? Are we in a new golden age of television? We were in love with Stranger Things. We've got a lot of stuff we're looking forward to. I mean, what's your read on it?
Definitely we're seeing a new form here, because the previous network miniseries have always been kind of the victim of sort of the bias against working in television, right?
Yeah.
And so people that want to, television has sort of classically suffered from being seen as entertainment versus art. And I actually think it's sort of a fallout from the fact that the blockbuster industry has gotten so safe. People are bringing their original properties and their complicated adaptions to the television screen, sort of seeding the theater to the next superhero movie. It's definitely fair to say that the TV's never been better. And I love it, because it tells us that my sort of vision of the television industry right now is like, if you watch Discovery Channel when they show like a dead whale and all the things just frothing up around it.
Feeding frenzy. Is that what you think? That's we got a feeding frenzy in store for us.
I think we're seeing it. I mean, the next thing that's going to happen is, honestly, we're just about to the point where if the cable company doesn't unbolt choice of channels, they're just going to lose all television, because right now streaming offerings from a given channel, like a Starz or a Showtime or HBO Go, they're getting down where they're sub $10, right?
Right.
When I can get HBO very inexpensively and get my Tyrion Lannister fix, and I can get Starz and I can get Shudder and I can procure all of these things, you know, you can get 5 or 10 really good streaming choices and still be well under the cost of a typical cable package.
Exactly.
They're really looking right down the barrel of getting turned into the internet utility. They're about to be the gas company of internet if they don't start to use their brain about their content channeling. And they're not willing right now. Right now, it looks like the way the wind is blowing for them is they're going to try to do it with lawyers. Like that's what the whole net neutrality thing is about. They want to go hard after people that are using their channel to deliver cable competition. I'm of the opinion they should not and probably cannot be allowed to do so. It was a technologically necessary monopoly for a while, but right now the state of the internet infrastructure business in the United States is holding us back technologically.
Yeah.
I mean, anybody that's been anywhere else on the Pacific Rim or many parts of Europe will tell you the United States, American exceptionalism is not at play in internet bandwidth packaging or cell phone bandwidth packaging. We are lagging behind in a couple areas. Sadly, I don't see anybody in the current field making it any better.
Well, I'll tell you what. Let's jump tracks and let's talk about our other trailer here. We're
angry digression. Angry.
So there's this up and coming. That's even unfair. I mean, the guy has been working professionally for a while now. But he's just kind of starting to get on mainstream radar, is Adam Wingard. And he's a genre director. And for the past few months, they've been teasing this super scary horror movie that he's doing. And they were calling it The Woods. And Adam Wingard was directing, and they were going to terrifying new horrors, untold, scare the hell out of everybody. Well, this week, Lionsgate has dropped the trailer for The Woods, which is no longer named The Woods. It is named Blair Witch. Huge bombshell. this movie that we've been anticipating for so long is actually a sequel to this well-established horror film, and people are losing their minds, including myself. But I wanted to...
Yeah. What a great stunt they did. What a nifty trick.
Well, anyway, we'll get to that in a second, but we're going to watch this trailer. Historically, though, if you want to go back and listen to our Monstoberfest episode on Haxan and the Blair Witch, you'll know that Matt and I actually came down on separate sides of the fence on the Blair Witch Project. A little history there, but yeah, let's give this new trailer a watch from Adam Wingard.
You really think your sister could still be out there after all these years?
If there is any chance that I could find out what happened to her, I need to try.
Legend said there's been a curse on these woods.
Do you believe in the stories about the Blair Witch?
Oh my God.
This looks familiar.
We've been walking in a circle.
No way.
They're everywhere. Who could have done this?
You did this!
Oh my God! This way, come on!
There's something out there.
Yeah. I don't know that trailer conveys the buzz. Like, if it weren't for the pool quotes in the trailer, I wouldn't have much of a takeaway from the trailer.
Yeah.
I'm willing to remain agnostic on the actual movie. The trailer didn't sell me that hard, except for the quotes from the people whose opinion I respect.
Interesting. Okay.
The trailer looked like horror things I've seen before. I didn't see what was new and more intense. I didn't see the blue water, the newly broken ground in that trailer. I didn't see Bad.
Yeah, honestly.
It looked like a...
As a fan of Adam Wingard and as somebody who is historically a fan of Blair Witch, I think this keyed into me because of those two names coming together. Number one, it's this huge bombshell that, oh my God, you know, surprise, we've been working on this. You know, that there is a level of excitement to that if you're a Blair Witch fan. Also, the fact that it's Adam Wingard doing it, and he's this name that, you know, is out there and needs to be more in front. And so a lot of people are kind of, he's the fan champion. Everybody's rooting for him. On that level, yeah, I'm super excited. However, I think you're right. I think just watching this cold off the street, I don't know that somebody who was born after 2003 is going to think this is anything special. Once again, with the exception of the fact that it's getting high marks from critics, which is included in this trailer. So yeah, I'm not sure that it's a great trailer for general audiences, but if they were targeting me, and it certainly feels like they were, I'm excited.
Yeah, I mean, I'll give it a chance. I didn't mind Blair Witch 2, and I sort of like the world building they did outside of the actual Blair Witch feature. And I really respect a good, you know, I joked about it before, but I actually like a good marketing stunt. I like some, I'm one to dabble in a new ARG or some sort of external property building. I kind of like some of that stuff.
And this is kind of why I wanted to watch this trailer more than anything else. So we had very short notice on Stranger Things. Like I mentioned, I think we maybe had a month of lead up into even knowing that this was going to be a thing. We saw that again in 10 Cloverfield Lane, where it's just kind of J.J. Abrams is like, oh, hey, surprise, here's a movie. We also saw it, like, not necessarily as intentionally, but the turnaround from the world premiere of Hush at South by Southwest to getting it on streaming and in people's living rooms was a matter of weeks. And so we're seeing this new kind of weird animal emerge. I'm not sure that I'm hating it. I think I really like this. Because now in the era of the internet, we know when a movie is just being talked about, or it might be in pre-production, and it might end up mired in production hell. But we're able to follow a film literally from cradle to grave. or Cradle to Bed.
Look at the toxicity around Ghostbusters before it. Just the mere, like, everybody hanging over every casting announcement and dickering and bickering about details of the movie before there's a script, before there's a single production still out, people have already sort of entered in their thought.
Well, and that's the thing. And we talked about this a little bit with our Star Wars episode, is that the biggest enemy of the audience going into a film like this is themselves, is their own expectations, is building something up so large in their mind that it has to be just like this or it won't be perfect. And then you get something else and you feel more disappointed than you would if you had walked in cold. I think that's eliminating that whole kind of speculation period, and I think it's a good thing. I think we may be getting our movie news a little too early. We're getting a little too involved. We're not leaving enough surprise out there. You know, walking into Ghostbusters 2, I've already read that everybody in the cast makes a cameo in the new one. And so at that point, it became a guessing game of who they're going to trot out next and who's going to play what role. Instead of just sitting down in a theater and being delighted by the fact that, oh my God, it's Annie Potts. This is, oh wow, that's really neat that I can pick that out and recognize that, and what a great homage. But since I was expecting it, it was nothing special. It was just like, oh, here's the Annie Potts cameo. And so I think there is something to be said about not being as granular with our media consumption about production on these films.
And I also think, like, okay, like Episode 7 had a couple really good trailers where they definitely showed you, oh, you're going back to a desert planet. Here is a Star Destroyer in wreckage form. We are immediately invoking where these events fall chronologically. We're telling you the story continues. But they didn't blow a lot of the story in the trailer. And I just think there's a point where it's like, Star Wars 7, that's relevant to my interest. Show me a little bit of the trailer. Okay, I saw a little bit. Looks like it's being competently executed. I'm on board. And sort of once you make the decision to see it, do you need to keep what? Oh, they recut the trailer. Now there's a 2-minute trailer. Now there's a Red Band trailer. Now there's a, you know. I just question the wisdom in building this big culture around was ultimately, I mean, at the end of the day, entertainment is a downtime activity.
Yeah.
and we're part of the segment that turns it into a bit of a bit more culture than maybe it needs to be, but I can't make fun of myself too much, but ultimately it's something you do for fun. And you know, ask Todd Marinovich what happens when you ruin the fun. That's probably, I just made the worst possible reference.
Yeah, that was,
to
that's
to Trevor.
It's a deep cut, man. I'm that one's over my head.
But yeah, my point is I made a sporting reference, but he was a guy whose dad broke his brain with sports pressure by sucking all the fun out of everything.
I think for the Nighthawks, a grander conversation about kind of the weird toxicity that's bubbling up around the corners of fan culture. And in some places where it's not bubbling up around the corners, it's eating away the face of. But I think we need to have a couple maybe roundtable discussions, bring in a few guests. And I think there's more to talk about there. But just as far as, you know, a capsule review of what we're talking about here, I think it's better not to know sometimes. And honestly, if they could pull off something on the level of like an Avengers or a Star Wars that's just kind of dropped on you, it's like, oh, hey, in 2 months, guess what? Avengers 3, bam, done. I think you would get so much more success and so much more excitement. You condense it into 2 months instead of having to stay excited about Star Wars for 2 years, you know, keeping that candle lit.
I'm not super fired up about the Blair Witch property, but I applaud the marketing stunt. Like, yeah, by all means, use your, what was it, Blue Horizon? Like, keep it secret?
Oh, yeah. Blue Harvest.
Oh, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, for those of you not in the know, Blue Harvest was the secret production name for Empire Strikes Back. So that way they could kind of keep things under wraps.
Like, I like the idea of just bringing stuff out of nowhere. Like, and I think it reflects, I don't know. The people behind Blair Witch have a history of innovative marketing, but it also reflects a little bit of confidence in the film. And that's what's missing right now. And I guess it's sort of a justified missing because, you know, we had great, you know, Edge of Tomorrow, the movie FKA All You Need Is Kill, the Tom Cruise vehicle, was a great original property that didn't do well at the box office because no one knew the license. And I actually think that failure was a harbinger of the super emphasis now on the superhero blockbuster and the kind of some of these soulless remakes we've been saying, like the new Independence Day and some stuff like that, where it's just like, yeah, they made it. It's good. It's not Ishtar, but...
All right. Well, I think that's enough digression for this particular episode. We're going to close things out.
Sweet, sweet digression.
But, yeah, find us on Stitcher, please. Find us on iTunes. Find us on Podomatic. Find us at fanboytv.com. Find us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook. You know the drill. You know this.
Tell your friends.
Yeah, honestly.
Put your favorite put your favorite episode on a thumb drive and leave it in a strange place.
Hey, no, do that. Do that. Do that and send us pictures. Let us know what episode you chose and where you left it. This could be fun. But, yeah, get in touch with us on Facebook. Let us know what's going on. Tell us how you're doing. But anyways, I think that's about going to do it for us. We're going to move back into Cafe Proper for our customary after discussion pie. Matt, anything else from you?
No, I'm spent.
All right. Well, folks, we're going to wrap things up. Sign off, because it's almost morning.